Welcome back to the Black Is Break with yours truly, Casey Lehman. We are having a holiday podcast roundtable tonight. Tonight's guests are Chris Lehman, Tash Mosley, Toria Williams, and John Wood. And tonight's topic is post-election wrap-up. It's just that simple. The election is over. Barack Obama is still president, and we are moving, as he would tell us, forward. So the question is now, you know, what do we expect from Obama? What changes do we think, if any, will happen with this administration? What is the future of, you know, the Democratic Party, and more importantly, the future of the Republican Party? It seems like they definitely had an awakening on this, or through this last election, in regard to where their party stands and how the majority of the country feels about that. If you all don't mind me starting, I don't have too much to say. I'm happy Obama's back in office. I do have to say our last podcast was really an eye-opener for me, and I have to credit some of that to Dr. Wayne Bird and a lot of his information about Monsanto and other different situations that are taking place in regards to politics that have made me become a lot more aware and pay more attention to just to how the system seems to work and who the different players are and the different ways large corporations have their hand in government, which is something that I think is entirely wrong. But with all of that, I do hope Obama is able to get health. Well, healthcare is definitely happening. That's a done deal. Obamacare is coming. I'm hope he's able to get some sort of movement happening as far as getting the budget passed. That's been a challenge for him in the past. I hope he's able to get past this Benghazi situation without too much drama. The mere fact I'm hearing people like John McCain mention the word Watergate in the midst of talking about how we should go about investigating what happened in Benghazi sounds like somebody's desire to possibly want to impeach Obama off of this situation. But I wish him the best of luck in this 4 years. The one thing that he said that stuck with me throughout the end of the election, like in the days before, is that we've watched him age before our eyes. And that's for sure. He's a good 8 years older now than he was when he first took office. And I imagine that in the next 4 years, he's going to definitely be looking like a good 60-year-old man with all that he's going to have to deal with. So I hope he's able to make some things happen that are to the benefit of the country overall. Republican Party, get it together.
Well, and on that note, this is John Wood. And Barack Obama has been reelected, and I say congratulations to the president. He ran an effective campaign. He might be the greatest politician who ever lived, honestly, just in terms of putting together an organization, campaigning, and beating the odds, you know. I mean, and I'm a Republican. I tend to be a little more conservative. Didn't vote for President Obama. But in my heart, of course, you know, I feel a great admiration for him. He is our first black president. And more than that, he shows in his life, in his biography, and in his eloquence just what is possible if you really have faith and conviction in your own abilities and if you believe in the opportunities that this country presents us with. So I am not at all sad to see him returning. I do, however, feel a great deal of concern for the country, and I hope that the president can find a way to sort of go back to his original 2008 message in spite of Republican intransigence and Democratic anger at the Tea Party and vice versa, that the president can find a way to build bridges between these sides. I always thought that that was his greatest quality. And we need it because this fiscal cliff that we're coming to in January is a serious problem.
And it affects us.
It will affect everybody. Taxes are going to go up by, I think, a total of $5 trillion. Spending will be cut about, I think, close to $2 trillion, not just from defense, but from Medicare and Social Security. Frankly, I don't really care at this point whether taxes go up on the rich or whether we do it all through deductions and loopholes. The parties need to meet somewhere in the middle. It's just gone so much farther than it ever should have gone, to the point to where our economy could risk going back into a recession just because we can't put a simple budget agreement together. And look, you can blame a lot of this on the Republicans and the Tea Party. I agree. But President Obama is the president, and he's got to find a way to make this happen. Otherwise, you know, his first second term is not going to start on a good note.
I think this term, I think a lot of credit has to be given to Michelle Obama as well. She spoke to the people, and it was genuine and it was sincere. And I think for the first time we saw her, for some reason, I felt like she was way more active this time around in the campaigning. And one of the things that stuck out to me, she said in all the years, she saw what he was made of in that. And I think that helped a lot. Everyone said, you know, it was dependent on the women's vote. And I didn't even feel like Michelle was speaking to women. She reminded everybody what it's like to just be the average person here in America. And I think that helped tremendously. I think President Obama knows, which is why in his speech he acknowledged, you know, falling in love, watching the world fall in love with his wife. And I think Michelle did wonders for his election this time. I'm pleased.
Well, you're not going to get any complaints about Michelle Obama out of me. I love her. I thought she was one of his biggest assets in conjunction with Bill Clinton this campaign season. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, her favorability polling is so much higher than his, and there's a good reason for it. I mean, she's swift, she's real, she's likable, but also she's not bearing the brunt of the responsibility. So she's allowed to be a little more free. And the responsibility is John articulates it of, you know, his being willing or building, because we know he's willing. And I think even you'd admit that, John, that he's expressed over and over again, even in his first 4 years, a willingness to work with an entrenched ideological Republican Party. But that his savvy about how to go about it now is so much better. And that I really do hope that he excels. I do think that this is a good opportunity and a lesson in civics for the American people. And the miseducation of the American people overall has been something that has always disappointed me. One of the people I love a lot is Frank Luntz, who you know, Toria, from his support of, is it the Alliance Schools? Yeah, he's a Republican pollster. He's on Fox News. You know, shortly after Obama won the election, he was on CBS This Morning with Charlie Rose and Norah O'Donnell, and he did a poll with Republicans in Virginia, which was a swing state. And he asked some just very candid questions, and the one question that really struck him about the answer was that many of the Republicans who articulated like a deep sadness, having cried when Mitt Romney lost, many of those Republicans truly believe that Obama is spearheading and is at the center of a new socialist front in this country. And it just really underscores the level to which people are miseducated about, one, the role that socialism plays through fire departments, free libraries, public education, police departments, and the way we need and thrive off of it in our economy and in our government, but then also about what socialism in government, in a free market government, really looks like. And to think that Obama, who's asking people to out of their own pocket to pay for their health care, and when there's no public option, is somehow the, you know, head of state of a new socialist wing of government. And these are people who earnestly, I mean, these weren't radicals. Frank Luntz didn't find Tea Partiers who are considered fringe. These are just people who are radical, who are earnest Republicans, and who believe that we're on the wrong track now that Obama has been reelected. And there's been a real schism, as we can see, and as much as, you know, The Daily Show and all these shows have made fun of Fox News and their followers, their reaction to Obama's win, there's been a real break in their consciousness. Like, we've lost a real traditional America. You know, we live in a country that's, you know, a lot more, that's a lot more full of takers than makers. And this is an opportunity for us to unpack. And we don't have, you know, the problem that Obama has is that as deep as he is and as literate as he is, he could write about this. And I mean, I think we'll get this in his diaries I pray that we get this in whatever he publishes about his time in office. But we don't have any leader there who is willing to usher us, to wade us through these deep waters and get us over to the other side as a nation. People are much more willing to exploit, like Nixon did and Lee Atwater, exploit these buzzwords that are code for racism so that you can get to a certain demographic. They're much willing to exploit these fears in order to build a constituency so that they get reelected. And until we have leaders who are just as concerned about our souls, and that doesn't mean that we all have to be Christians, by the way, but who are just as concerned about our souls and our development and our education as a populace, we're still going to be, like, we're going to have heated conversations centered on race, on politics, on socialism, like a red scare. We're going to have another red scare. And it's just, I don't know. I just really... I would love for us to take this time to learn something about ourselves. And on that point, too, I mentioned Lee Atwater and Nixon. You know, I guess, what is it, Jimmy Carter's grandson, who recorded the 47% statement of Romney, he also got access to Lee Atwater's address to a Republican caucus in 1982 about how to talk to your constituency and have them and trigger certain ideas of, like, oh, those people are trying to take what you built and made. And how to code it, how to basically code your message, race code it, so that, you know, you can dog whistle and speak to your constituency, mm-hmm. like, so welfare queen and urban, you know, the certain words. Mm-hmm. And it seems like people are willing to, are not willing to even talk about that. There's, of course, MSNBC, you know, they talked about it, but that doesn't really count. We need everyone to talk about how that was Nixon's agenda. And the Republican Party took it, starting with the war on drugs, like, you know, the hippies, the like those fringe people who don't understand us real Americans. It was to marginalize, you know, the other. And the war on drugs affected Black people more than anything. And I don't know. I'm just ready for us to grow and develop.
Well, that's one of the points that I know I made at the original session was, I feel like the biggest pink elephant in the room is how race has been a factor as far as government is concerned, ever since Obama even had the nerve to run for the office of president. And it's the one conversation that nobody is blatantly having. Everybody's kind of dancing around it and also swearing it's not an issue when everybody's actions showcase how great of an issue it actually is. You kept mentioning buzzwords and keywords, and the buzz keyword that kept sticking for me coming from the Republican Party, all sex of it really, was this word of tradition, our history. And I'm like, if we're really looking at the tradition and history of this country is founded on a lot of racist ideals. It's all about, you know, one particular group remaining in power while other groups kind of work to their benefit. So if we're talking about staying in that tradition, then we have to acknowledge that that focuses on one superior race, that being the white race, and everybody else being inferior. And as long as the Republican Party or members of the Republican Party are not willing to just... I guess I prefer my bigots to just be real bigots. Like, right. don't wear the mask. Be honest and say, I don't care for other people of color. I don't, because honestly... there are victims of their own region and their own history. I was thinking about
that. Suffering. They're supporting policies that don't support their greater interests.
Right. I was watching the documentary on Ole Miss, and when it was first integrated. Right. With James Meredith first integrated. And there was a man on there who said, he had a really wonderful line. And he was saying, you know, so much of what we deal with down here in the South, there's a lot of our history that's really great, but there's so much of it that has made us infamous. And he was like, you know, it makes him think of something that William Faulkner said, and that is, the past is never dead. In fact, it's not even past. So, you know, you're still dealing with the issues of your history every single day. They don't go anywhere. You know, and the people in the South and all the various areas, the states that are just hardcore, going to always be red. They're dealing with a history that they felt was what was the backbone. And it really was, to some degree, the foundation of this country. And the fact that things are starting to get a lot more, for them, complicated, diverse, different, and doesn't look like what they believe things are supposed to look like, is a scary realization for
something
them.
Something I just learned to support you, your comment about history and buzz terms that I didn't know existed, or I didn't know this was the origin of it. The term states' rights is a dog whistle to, oh, no, as a state, we're allowed to have slaves. Like, so it's the whole states' rights movement that Republicans often cling to. Like, it's actual origin and original implementation was to, you know, like, the Great Compromise, the states that were allowed to be slave states compared to those that weren't. And and these are things that, like, it's okay to be pro-states' rights. It's okay to be pro, you know, pro-Dixie, even, for that matter. But just really understand, what are you fighting for? What are you believing in when you say you're pro-states' rights? So that means if you're consistent to the principle, oh, you agree with Colorado and the states that allow that have recreational marijuana and the states that allow gay marriage. If it's really a principle of states' rights, then by all means, like, anybody who tells me they're pro-life and they're against the death penalty, I'm quiet. Because otherwise, if you're pro-life and you're for the death penalty, no, you're just an anti-abortion person. You're not pro-life. And I like to make that distinction all the time. I do have a couple. I have a wish list, a long wish list. It's like my liberal wish list of what Obama addresses this term. And it's really long, and I'm just going to rattle it off. And I want him to end
it is long.
The war on drugs. Immigration reform for my Latino, period. They
all
have to be
immigrants.
Latino. Yeah, thank you. They can be from Africa. This one's huge, and it's kind of relevant now. I would be kind of dope if the black man brokered peace in the Middle East. You know, let's see. I would like him to strengthen labor rights. I honestly believe that America's big stain is not so much slavery, even though slavery is indicative of the labor rights. I think it's labor rights that's America's big stain. Whether it's we have kids working at the turn of the 20th century, you know, the work hour, how many days you could work. Slavery was just free labor, and now it's, you know, our schizophrenic nature with illegal immigrants and how we like to use their cheap labor, but we're not willing to give them citizenship or a path to citizenship. What else? Cuba. I want him to end the Cuban embargo. That's something else. I mean, like, you know, China's still a communist country, and we allow, you know, the second we started trading with them, they have open markets and they've grown, and look at where they are now. So why can't we do the same with Cuba?
Finally get my cigars.
Says the Republican.
Right. And look, and
that's all you care about.
I heard a rumor Puerto Rico is considering becoming the next state.
Let's make them. Let's
do
them
it.
Puerto Rico.
Oh.
Yeah, those are a couple of things on
his
my
Christmas
wish list.
Yeah.
I guess the thing that has been bothering me post the election, and I'm not going to spend the whole thing ragging on the Republican Party, but when I hear when I hear them talking about the way that they plan to retool for 2016, one, all black people are completely factored out. African Americans are not a consideration at all for retooling, which in my mind, I'm really starting to adopt Marcus Garvey's mindset. Not necessarily go back to Africa, but go somewhere, because it's hard to consider a place home when nobody considers you important, or your perspective is not even a factor for consideration. But they're going to try to galvanize the Latino vote as much as possible. They're going to harp on family values and Christian and I guess Catholicism, since there's a large demographic of Hispanic people that are Catholic, and they do, you know, have their families and kids and husbands and all of that. They want the Asian vote. So whatever they got to do to get Asians on their side as well. Don't know what they're going to do about abortion. Have no idea what they're going to do about that, because they definitely distance themselves from a lot of women. If we're talking 2000, think about how many conversations we have had at this table about single independent women. And if you start having the whole conversation of
birth control instead of just abortion, I mean,
right.
Like, something that's simple. We don't have to take it that extreme.
Yeah. Like, it's 2012. You have to think so much more progressively than the stance that they're taking. Everybody is not going to have the traditional hookup, you know what I'm saying? Not going to have the traditional family setup. So all of those rules just no longer apply. So just keep in mind, this is my prediction for 2013. The Republican presidential nominee will be Hispanic.
Wow.
Guaranteed.
I mean, there was an article by a Republican pundit who said...
Is that the one in Florida?
I was going to say in Texas.
He said something about like, yeah, we need to retool and we basically need to change our stance on immigration reform and nominate Marco Rubio.
Yep, that's the guy. That's the one. And I have a Republican co-worker who is very strong in her beliefs, and we were talking about Rubio, and she's like, oh yeah, he'll definitely win. If he runs, he's winning.
Hmm.
Marco Rubio is Cuban. He would be a great candidate. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, for clarity's sake.
Yeah. Well, it's important to make the distinction, because I'm still not sold on the idea that Mexicans will necessarily vote for a guy just because he's broadly Hispanic.
Particularly because he's Cuban.
But but I think people might vote for Rubio, because I honestly think Rubio would be a fantastic candidate, not just because he's Latino, just because the guy is tough. Mm-hmm. He knows what he's talking about. There are a lot of things I could say to respond to some of the points that you guys have raised here. I'm not going to go and try and tackle all of them. I think that, but I appreciate the spirit in which we're talking, because it's important for us to understand one another. It's important for us to understand each other across party and ideological lines. It may be even more important for us to understand each other across racial lines. And you know what? I've really undergone a bit of a transformation in my own thinking in a certain sense, because you know, one of the things I liked about Obama, because it reflects some of the ways that I think, is that he seemed to believe in a sense, a post-racial America. And while I never believed that we were at that point, I believe that that's a worthy goal. And some people believe that you got to get away from all the animosity of the racial conversation to make that happen. But now I think that maybe you really need to plunge yourself into it. So that being said, I want to sort of speak on behalf of white people for a minute, because I'm actually dead serious about this, because I am white, you know? I mean, my father's white. And when you guys talk about these, you know, Tea Party folks and their attitudes and whatnot, and I don't say this to be antagonistic, but you are talking about my father, you know? He's not a registered Republican, but he's a conservative white man who looks at the president and believes he's ushering us into an era of socialism. But he's my father, and his heroes in life were Muhammad Ali and Willie Mays. He's a jazz pianist. He's played with guys like Joe Henderson and Woody Shaw and Billy Higgins, and grew up around black people, you know, married my mother, had me and my brother, you know. It's really not a race thing with him.
I said it was earnest. Substance. Yeah, these people truly believe it. And my only
I appreciate you saying
that. These policies, because it's so earnest, these policies, ideas have been around for a while, some of them suggested by Republicans. So I think it's important to understand what makes us now a socialist.
I don't disagree that there is a deep-rooted misunderstanding of what socialism is on the conservative right. I absolutely agree with that. And I think that things like that documentary 2016 that Dinesh D'Souza produced was sort of an academic and intellectual travesty, really, because it seems to prey on these misconceptions, whether deliberately or accidentally, and reinforces them. But there's some liberal misconceptions, too. And that's the idea that just because you are, a small government or a social or religious conservative, you are a racist, or that is even broadly true. In my experience, I just can't testify that, not just because of my own politics, because of my father's politics and because of my family's politics. I have conservative white people in my family, you know. And you talked about states' rights being a buzzword for segregation or racism or slavery.
Having origins. Having its roots there. And for some, it conjures up the idea of...
That is true, but it's not completely true. You have to go back to the origins of the issue and recall that in the constitutional battle between the Confederates and the Unionists before the Civil War, you know, slavery was one issue that wound up becoming the central issue in a broader ideological struggle.
Before
between
the Constitution, that's what the Great Compromise was
about. And after,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right. And slavery was one issue, and later on segregation would be one issue. And on those issues, those small government and states' rights conservatives were wrong. And history showed that, and they were beaten, you know. But that doesn't negate the basic philosophy of states' rights outside of that when it comes to economic rights, when it comes to the political rights of state legislatures and local governments to be able to determine our own economics. Over the course of history, what you saw is that all people have to be treated equal. But it doesn't negate the basic premise of conservatism on the political scale. And my let me criticize Republicans
is something that they've never really had the opportunity to unpack and acknowledge. Oh, we were wrong on this moment. So it's like you said, it's not anything that we've addressed.
You don't have any serious conservatives today saying that, you know, that segregation was the right thing to do or anything like that. Look. They were beaten. Those conservatives were beaten a long time ago. And I'm not saying that they're not still some racists left, but it's important to make a bit of a distinction, you know? And you've said it. Just because you have these political ideas does not mean that you're racist. But the historic connection is such that it's really difficult for people to see people, especially white people, who have these small government ideas and say, well, this is a person who's, you know, probably wants to oppress or regulate, you know, minorities or people who aren't part of that ideological tradition that he's coming from. And I understand that, you know. I understand that because it is true. You know, when Reagan was running, and I think Reagan was a great president in many respects, but Ronald Reagan and George Romney probably had similar views on the role of state governments on a lot of political levels. But Reagan and Barry Goldwater and other conservatives took that to the point to where they believed that segregation was, you know, something that, not to suggest that Reagan was personally a racist, but that it was nevertheless constitutional in line with their principles. But you always had more forward-thinking conservatives, people like George Romney, people like Nelson Rockefeller, people like, ironically, Richard Nixon, who, even though he picked up the dog whistle when it was politically you know, he felt it was politically necessary for him later on, nevertheless came out in the 50s in favor of full integration and went way out of his way to initiate public-private partnerships with black business owners, who was endorsed by Martin Luther King Jr. because of it, you know. You know, it's a complicated thing, but it's just to say that Republicans, what they have needed to do for a long time and have failed to do, is to distill what I believe are the worthy merits of their political ideas and divorce them from that old history.
I completely agree.
Absolutely.
To divorce them of that old history, segregation, remove the dog whistles and whatnot, and focus on the merits of the arguments. And I think they've failed to do that, and I think that that's one of the reasons the Republican Party is looked at as being so regressive. But I have to emphasize, it doesn't mean that most Republicans are racist. It doesn't mean that most white people are racist. Well, I'm not necessarily talking to you guys, but I think that there are many people listening who do think that, or at least some people, even if it's just 5 or 10%. I have to talk to those people. Look, I'm a Republican.
I think it would be better if you talked to Republicans. See, and this is
trying to talk to them. There are only so many Republicans listening.
No. But in general, I think my issue with Republicans is that when you have an opportunity someone like yourself who, you know, is speaking to people who have beliefs that Obama is leading a new socialist frontier in this country, instead of saying, hey, I'm a conservative and I need you to enumerate the policies and explain to me why you believe that. And then just one by one, break down why that's inappropriate and why that is wrong. And help them walk them through it. Or just like Republicans who deny climate change. And now there's some who agree that climate change is happening, but as a stall tactic, they're saying, well, if we had signed the Kyoto Treaty, we wouldn't be any better off now. Or, you know, well, what do you want to do? Everything needs to be on the table. It's just so overwhelming. We can't. And there's no Republican who's saying, wait, stop. Are we willing to acknowledge that this has existed? And it was a time in our party where we were denying the absolute truth. That said, let's move on and let's address it. And I don't feel there's anybody on the Republican side who's addressing those issues. Instead, they kind of walk a fine line about how Democrats need to be balanced too, and how, you guys need to address your own skeletons in the closet, air them out, and then, like you said, then you'll be better equipped to, distill your message so that people can get it. I didn't harp on the McCain comment about about Susan Rice, because I think that's not racism at all. Like, they were in favor of Condoleezza Rice, and she was a black woman. Yeah. They're just right. not in favor of Susan Rice.
John McCain was more big, was Susan Condoleezza's biggest supporter in the Senate.
Yeah, exactly.
People call him racist.
Calling him a racist seemed absurd, because on principle alone, it seems as if he's willing to support a black woman when her policies align with his. Now, he might be foolish in his attack on Susan Rice now, but that's a whole other
issue. It's a different
issue. Yeah. So the racism and even you bringing like me calling these people racist into it, or anybody calling them racist into it, doesn't address the real issue that needs to be addressed, which is the faction of it that is racist.
And that gets so much FaceTime.
Yeah, and that needs to be, what's the word, exorcised? I don't know. Yeah, yeah, like, well, an exorcism.
And you know, and Kim was talking about Wayne Byrd. You guys should check out on one of our previous podcasts. But it just, thinking about him, I don't go nearly to his extreme and not trusting the system. But the reason I... And you guys know I play a bit of a contrarian in our podcast because I'm...
We appreciate it, too.
Just because, you know, I'm the...
Because you're the youngest.
Yeah, that's...
Because you're the youngest.
But Tash was talking about what the real problem is, that one racist faction in the Republican Party. And I agree to the extent that that's there, that needs to be weeded out. And I do think that... you know, one day we'll get to a point where we're in the promised land that King saw. We don't have to worry about any of that. But the reason I mention things in the context I do is because when we look at the interests that control our politics, not just the monetary interests, but the media interests, and you talk about how these races get so much FaceTime, you got to understand, just as it is the case that there are media interests and political interests and monetary interests who benefit so much from stirring up fear of socialism, and Sharia law and these other things among, you know, the conservative right and the white right wing in the country, so too are there forces that want us to believe that America is such a racist country that there's just no point in even trying to communicate with people on the other side of the aisle, that mm-hmm. want us to believe that, you know, anybody...
Is there an entertainment complex that's entrenched in supporting that and has, like, a viewership that... I'm gonna call you. That's a false equivalency. I don't think on the left. Just cite one. Give me one popular media outlet that has the audience that say a Drudge Report or a Fox News or anything on the left that supports that America is a country where you cannot have opportunity. That's so entrenched in racism that you should not try. Mm. You have one?
Yeah. Did you ever watch Keith Olbermann? You know, did you ever watch?
Yes. And so clearly you didn't watch.
Do you remember? I watched an episode.
The message for people of color on Keith Olbermann and Lawrence O'Donnell is not you should not try because America is so entrenched in.
You're focusing on the wrong thing, though. But you were talking about how, you know, on the right they say that Obama's... Fox News never actually came out and said that Barack Obama is officially a card-carrying socialist. We're talking about implications and reading between the lines and this, that, or the other, you know. So, I'm speaking of those. But I remember Keith Olbermann saying that, you know, the only proof you need to know that the Tea Party is racist is to see that there are not any black people in the Tea Party. Now, you can tell me, Tash, if you feel that that's a reasonable comment. I think that the reason they're not, or that there are scarcely any black people in the Tea Party is because black people don't share Tea Party politics. Simple as
that.
But
why is that?
Well, and that's a worthy question, but it's an aside from the point that it's a reflection of Tea Party racism,
which is not the litmus test that they're racist.
So you agree with me on that point. So,
but he's not saying that the entire government, he's just saying that a faction... I mean, and I've heard...
No, I'm not necessarily... I didn't say government. I said the right wing.
I've heard him say that this is a small faction of the right wing that got a lot of play during the town hall meetings leading up to...
Keith Olbermann said the Tea Party. And at a certain point, 70 to 80 million Americans identified themselves with the Tea Party. And he said that during the height of the Obamacare era.
But we talked about the miseducation of Americans. So you can get easily... If you lay out some broad principles about, like, yeah, less taxes, you could probably get 100 million Americans who can identify with the Tea Party, because
which is precisely why the comment was absurd, you know.
As well as that poll.
Well, okay, yeah, yeah. There's, and that's my point, that there's such a proliferation of absurdity on all sides, and you can say, well, one side is worse than the other. That no, and sure, that's there's certainly an argument to be made for that.
Would you make that argument that a party that denies climate change?
You know, I don't. If a person honestly and reasonably believes that climate change is not something that's happening, I mean, right. they may be dead wrong, but that's nothing. No, you know, no, there's nothing corrupt about that
okay.
view if it's honestly
held. It's okay
held.
To believe that it's
you know?
Not.
So
I don't see
the
that
equivalence.
If that's the case, then you have to acknowledge that 2 + 2 does not necessarily equal 4. I mean, if you believe in math and you believe in science and you can still believe in God at the same time, by the way, those two things are not mutually exclusive. There are a lot of scientists who find God in science. Then if you have a study, I mean,
well, Tash, look, I have to admit, I'm probably overmatched by you on the climate change issue simply because it's not an issue I've looked into with the depth I think that you have. I do know that a lot of people are much more educated than I am.
Do you think it exists?
I think it's probable, but again...
Right. Then that's the miseducation I'm talking about. The fact that there's a party in
but that's not proven by the fact that I think it's probable or improbable.
No,
look, there are a lot of geologists
that's
and
indicative.
Scientists who don't believe
there aren't
in
a
climate change.
No,
maybe not relative to the number that do think there are that do think it is a real phenomenon.
No,
I'm just saying that scientific minority is there, and they probably know more about the issue than you or I do. So I don't say that to suggest
no
that
one
you're
knows
wrong.
Anything more about anything than me?
I don't say that. To
and
suggest
he believes that he's not joking.
No, my point is I don't say that to suggest that Tash is wrong. Therefore, obviously not. Tash is probably right. I'm just saying that I don't view disbelief in climate change.
But you see the problem
as
here.
Okay.
Moral
Here's my question, though.
There's no moral line that you've drawn in the sand. That probably right. That's the problem with your party. Is that you guys have these like soft?
No, I don't. I don't think that that's. I don't think that's an issue.
No. No, but when on issues of
Tash,
like
why would you ask me to be definitive about something that I have not studied? Look, I'm not a person. I don't go out and say I. Yeah. I don't say I have a solid opinion on something that I have not
say,
really poured myself
but
into.
But you can just say, I honestly don't know enough
no,
about
I don't.
It to comment, period.
I don't
but
know. I'm just saying.
Here's
I'm
my question, though.
Like,
I'm saying
for me to be wrong.
I have a distinct question for you, Wood. I have a distinct question for you.
I don't understand. Tash, have
you started?
Tash, you've never had an opinion say, well, I lean towards this point of view, but I'm not 100%. Are you 100% certain on everything that you believe? Because if that's true, you really do believe everything you think.
No, that's not true. But if I don't know about it, I won't give my opinion. And my opinion, someone gives me more facts. We're like, okay, listen, I need to reassess what I know. And then I come out on one end or the other.
Well, let me ask you this, because you made some really poignant points to me when you began this conversation. One about being a biracial man and having this experience, identifying with your white side and understanding the white conservative perspective, because that is your father's perspective and some of your family's perspective as well. If race is not the underlying issue, because see, here's the thing. If we're looking at the RNC and pretty much almost any forum where there was a large number of people congregating on the behalf of Mitt Romney, it was extremely devoid of color. Everybody was discussing that fact. The fact that when you went to Democratic events, there were
so much more diverse.
Even when we looked at on election night, the two different crowds, I mean, they were distinctly different as it pertained to race and culture. If race is not the
at the Puerto Rican delegation
right.
when they came up.
If race is not the issue that then separates and makes these groups have this racial difference and distinction when it comes to support, then what is it? Is it a socioeconomic divide? Like, what is it that create? Why aren't there more people of color that support the Republican Party? Why is the Democratic Party that much more diverse? What is it?
There's a number of points to be made in answer to that. The main thing is history. And for ethnic minorities in this country, and certainly and foremost for Black Americans, we had always been placed in a grossly underprivileged position because we were not allowed to partake in the freedoms that are enumerated in the Constitution and implied by the Declaration of Independence. So while a sort of free market, somewhat laissez-faire, limited government recipe for prosperity worked very well for the country as a whole since its founding, it didn't do anything for us because we were not allowed to partake and participate in that system. And because of that, that only really left us with one real option outside of the sort of Booker T. Washington incrementalist view, which certainly had its worthy place. But the only real thing we could do is engage in collectivist action to petition and push the government to grant us the rights that we required, that we should have been entitled to from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So what I believe that did was it set in place a long history of activism in the Black community, with which we are all familiar with and rightly proud, wherein our focus has always been on moving the government the federal government particularly, to move events in a way that would equalize opportunity, and we were right to do that. It's just that philosophy, given the circumstances of Blacks and minorities in general throughout our history, obviously we weren't going to be thinking in terms of free market liberty because, you know, white people were using the free market to club us. We weren't going to think in terms of states' rights because, as Tash pointed out, there's a segment of the states' rights argument that had always been used as an excuse to first enslave and then oppress us via segregation. So we were never going to buy in to those conservative principles, even though on the broader macro scale, they worked very well for the country as a whole, and I would contend would always have worked well for us if the country had simply lived up to its founding principles, which it failed to do. But because we weren't given a place in those principles, we had to fight our way through there, and the only effective way to do that was through the government. I do think, and I think that Obama's election, not just that, so many other things, I think that we've come to a place where we have enough power and freedom now to where we can use that age-old, you know, you can call it conservative, but really it's just sort of, you know, just sort of the basic liberal democratic, and when I say liberal democratic, I mean in the founding father sense, that basic American recipe of free enterprise and political freedom. I think Black people are in a position now where we can begin to harness that formula because we have enough rights and political power to do it, you know? And that doesn't necessarily mean you got to be Republican or Democrat or identify yourself this way or that way. It simply means that we need to move into a mode where we can no longer just petition the government for everything because really, and I think I honor King and those who fought and died for us prior to this moment in saying this, we've achieved a place where, at least on the surface, we have legal and political parity before the law with white people. Now, that doesn't mean it works out that way in practice all the time, but we are in such a better position now to where we have the opportunity to pool our economic and our educational resources to really thrive in an economic sense, in an educational sense, and I think, and in a political sense, you know, we just have to be able to, I think, see how that best works out for the broader prosperity of ourselves and then for the country. And that's the point I want us to get to where we can have a very simple sort of one-to-one conversation about the merits of liberal and conservative ideas without the ad hominem attacks about racism and socialism and all these other things that distract from it. It's an issue of ideas. And I think that Black people are in a position now to where we can take the ideas that have really, you know, in my opinion, really worked very well for America since the beginning and really harness them to our own wagon and pull it ourselves, you know, in the future.
I have one final question for the table. What do you guys think about the fact that we continue to focus on the Republican and Democratic Party as if this is really only a two-party situation? I found another interesting documentary given to me by Dr. Bird that talked about the setup of the presidential debates and how they used to be set up by, I think it was the League for Women, and that's how they were able to have third-party candidates. If a third-party candidate had a certain percentage, I guess, of the polls as far as popular vote was concerned, they were able to participate in the debates. And that's how we had, Ross Perot? Was he the last person?
I believe so.
Was it him or Nader? I get everything mixed up.
Well,
I think Nader was in a debate, right?
Was Perot. So that's the last time we had a third party situation. And at some point,
he was a clown.
Yeah, at some point he was a smart man. At some point, the Democratic Party. At some point, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party kind of co-opted the situation and put the debates in the hands of another system, so to speak. They took it away from the League of Women, which was a civic organization, and put it in this sort of privatized organization that made it where whoever the third party candidate was, the percentage of their popularity was higher, and it was something that was like completely unforeseen from a third party candidate that didn't have the sort of financial backing both the Democratic and Republican parties have. And since they kind of co-opted it, we now only have had those two parties talk. And I feel like that's really not fair, since there always are other people on the ballot who we don't get to hear from or listen to. And there could very well be somebody on that list who has a plan that might be beneficial for everybody. What do you guys think about that?
Well, I think, Wayne's,
and what can we do about it?
Right.
That's really the question.
Wayne's, unless I might be mistaken, but I think Wayne's history is a little bit off.
I watched this. I watched this on CNN.
Well, were there major?
Even if Wayne's history is off. I think the main.
No, I understand. I understand the point. I just as a technical. I thought that Ross Perot was the only third party candidate ever in a major debate between the two nominees plus any third party candidates. There may have been primaries or off sort, you know, League of Women Voters may have had their own debate or something like that. But I don't think there was ever a nationally televised debate with a third party candidate aside from Ross Perot. But your point is well taken, Kim. I would say people be careful, beware of what you wish for, because in Latin America and Europe, there are plenty of places, parliamentary democracies, who have multiple parties and they don't get anything done either. it's possible to have 10 parties that can't figure anything out with weak coalition governments as it is to have two parties who don't get anything done. I think that the most important thing is just this fundamental question of us, because politics is downwind of culture at the end of the day. And so, it's really incumbent upon regular people to start understanding each other. And I think that will improve the conversation in Washington. I really want Obama to do his best to lead lead that movement. But it is up to us at the end of the day, whether there's 10 parties or two parties. I do think the system is sort of rigged against third parties. But so I please support your third party if that's what you really want to do. That's great. But it's still a matter of the fundamentals.
Who has the money? Perot had money.
Perot had money, and he was able to pull high because he was able to put a campaign infrastructure in place because he had assets. He had the dough to make that happen. So yeah, money is a big part.
You pay for your mic.
Right. One thing I observed this time around, and it's just my own observation, I think people were more aware and more conscious because you did hear people kind of bringing that conversation up. You could be in a room with someone who was a Democrat, and I use my fingers in quotes, but still kind of questioned. And I felt like this election this time around, for some reason, people seemed to be a lot more aware, a lot more conscious, even Black people, who were holding President Obama accountable, which was good for me. And that was the message that was being sent out a lot to this year. Just be aware, you're going to compromise, is what the bishop, one of our bishops said, you're going to compromise no matter which way you vote. You're going to make a compromise. You're going to give up something.
Right.
Yeah. I think on the idea of compromise I guess the original point was third party. Why isn't there a prominent third party, and why aren't they allowed to participate in the debates? And I wish I had my facts with me, but the DNC and the RNC, it's well known, and it's like just common knowledge that they lobby to make sure that they don't have to, in a presidential debate, argue against anybody but one other competitor. So they kind of
arguing against one party.
They come together, they set the rules, and one of the probably written rules, but understood, is that we're not letting anybody else in because it's already hard to lock up the votes, the constituents, based off of the constituencies we've piecemealed together that way. But then
the fact that the debates are financed by like 7 corporations. There's seven. Wow. There's seven.
I didn't
even
know that. Yeah, that would bother me.
There used to be 10, but there are 7 corporations that sponsor all of the debates. The only one I can remember at this moment is Southwest Airlines. So our our little cheap flights here from here to Vegas
clearly
are paying for the debates. But to me, just knowing that there are 7 corporations behind it, they're the ones, to me, who make the decisions on what's discussed and what's not discussed. I hate that about it, because sometimes, to me, some of the questions are really frivolous. Although this year, the debates were on point. They were pretty rigorous. But sometimes they're asking...
The first and the... third. I think that second one was
kind of... I don't know. But sometimes the debate questions to me are just... they're frivolous. Especially the ones that are town hall, where they're supposed to be coming from people and it's just, I guess, at random. But it's
so not at
random. Yeah, it's just... I don't know.
I agree with John that the I don't know how you said it, but politics is a downstream...
Downwind
of culture. Thank you. And I completely agree. The one thing of that point that you made that I would reject is that it's President Obama's responsibility, or that he has any responsibility into helping the people within the culture understand each other more, because I found that...
Within what culture?
The divide, the political divide. Okay. So people who identify Tea Party versus ultra-liberal, like, okay, you know, Dr. Bird or whomever. I found that from my assessment of what he's done, that he's been willing to do that, but that folks within those particular sects haven't really made the effort to move beyond wherever they're getting their information, the big entertainment complex that is set up behind those people getting informed, and really reach out and reach a hand out. And so to put the responsibility on him, I feel as if I'm a little wary of it. I feel as if it's more politics, so that if somehow the people within the culture who have different political beliefs don't come together, somehow it's his responsibility when he's reached out over and over again.
What do you guys think the possibility of having a presidential candidate, although we've already pretty much assessed that possibility of a Cuban presidential candidate is great for 2016, but do you think now Obama has opened the door for us that to the point where we'll now see maybe Asian American candidates?
It would be awesome if we never saw, I mean, I'm being kind of facetious here, but how kind of cool would it be, and I'd be okay with this, if we never saw a white male
president
ever again. Now, mind you, I would trade Obama right now for a Dennis Kucinich presidency. I'd rather have a president whose principles completely are aligned with mine, but I don't need a president to be a man. I don't need a president to be a black. I don't need a president to be Latino or white. I want a president whose ideals kind of align and policies align with mine. And I think it would be really cool and indicative of the highest aspirations of America if perchance a white guy was never.
No.
You could go a white woman.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that would be nice,
be dope,
but I don't,
right?
You know, but that's playing on the fact that it would be great if everybody just went off the belief that this person is the right person because their ideas, and that's it.
That's
but
how
we
it
know.
Should be. It should be a meritocracy.
But that's...
If you said that, I don't think anybody would have a problem with that. You seem kind of be slamming the door on having a
said,
it's kind of sounded like you said, I would love it if Dennis Kucinich were president, but if he were, you know, black or Asian or something and a woman, I would like it even more.
No,
that kind of okay. Well, that's how that sounds.
No, but I would marvel at the idea.
You've had your share of white presidents.
No, I would just marvel at the idea that.
Well, look,
if it didn't happen for one, it would be by chance. But it's a certain type of chance that if it took place, I wouldn't have
there's no problem with that if that happened.
As well?
No, there's no problem if there's never a white president again, as so long as the presidents who win are just always the best candidates, which probably is not going to necessarily be the case. But if every president from now till eternity was white, or if no president from now till eternity was white, if they're all black or Asian or Indian or whatever, you know, so long as we're voting for the right reasons, that's the thing that matters the most.
Agreed.
So.
I'm just going to say that I know you guys have hopes. I honestly think the next president is going to be between two white men again. I mean, I think everybody's outlook is to, you know, Hillary and the Cuban guy that you guys mentioned. That would be
Rubio.
The idea. But, I mean, what happens if he's running, and he's running against a white man. Are Democrats going to say, well, you know, we like this person? You know, because what if they, Republicans, like, all right, we weed out all the racists at our party. Does that mean America is not racist anymore? No, there's racists in the Democrats. They just keep it on the low, just that's like right. the True. Whole North versus the South.
The Atwater True. Worked for Bill Clinton.
it would be nice, but you know, I think that white men are ready to get back in. They're like, all right, we had 8 years, we good. We don't let's get back to what we know.
It would be nice if they didn't even if they didn't even think like that. If they didn't think that somehow like they're getting back in is a thing. Right. It's not for me. It's never been a thing for me that they've been presidents. It's not a thing for me that Barack Obama's president. Hillary Clinton, it was an article in the New York Times or maybe the New Yorker that if she ran for presidency in 4 years, she Which would she be the most prepared candidate in the history wow. of American politics.
I believe it.
From her position, she knows how the Senate works. She has been Secretary of State and presided over a very successful, beside this, what is trying to be manufactured into Benghazi Gate. she has presided over one of the most successful foreign policies as Secretary of State. She's been
the wife
first
of a president.
Lady. Yeah, the first lady. Like,
she's seen all she's the issues from the gamut.
She was dope in 2000. She should have ran after Bill got out of the office. That's what I feel.
She was traumatized.
She's gonna. she's gonna be. Yeah, she's gonna be heavily favored, of course.
Well, we thank you all for tuning in. We have a good 4 years to see what's gonna happen. Make sure you check back in with us for the next Black Is Bright piece.